Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 22nd of March. As a senator from Tennessee some 20 years ago, Al Gore called the Senate's first climate change hearing. Yesterday, he brought with him some 516,000 signatures on petitions demanding immediate action to solve the climate crisis. He said, "I want to testify," and he did before House and Senate committees, "about what I believe is a planetary emergency, a crisis that threatens the survival of our civilization and the habitability of the Earth. The consequences are mainly negative and headed toward catastrophe, that is, unless we act." And he talked about how we should be acting. This was Gore's first visit to the Hill since the year 2000, and it was an emotional day. He appeared before House and Senate committees, and this hour of the program we will be talking about what he called the fever that the planet has. Our guest is Professor David Archer. He's a professor in the Department of Geophysical Sciences at the University of Chicago and has worked on many topics pertaining to the global carbon cycle and its relation to global warming. He currently teaches classes on global warming, environmental chemistry, and global geochemical cycles. He's the author of a textbook for non-science major undergraduates called Global Warming, Understanding the Forecast. And at this very moment, he's working on a new book, From Here to Eternity, Global Warming in Geologic Time. He's a contributing editor to the climate science blog site, realclimate.org. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We'll get many on this topic, I'm sure. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Should you be joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Professor Archer, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Okay.
Good. Yesterday, Al Gore called global warming a true planetary emergency. Would you use similar words?
Yeah, that seems like a reasonable summary, sure.
Mm-hmm.
What the downsides are going to be are sort of hard to pin down exactly, but the idea that they could be something we want to be concerned about, yeah, I would buy into that. Sure.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about his, it certainly got a lot of press, tell me about his presence yesterday. Does it take in this day and age somebody who's won an Academy Award, you know, who's had this strong political past? He was treated with some reverence. Some of those who don't believe there is global warming really took him on yesterday. But he has a whole new stature now as being this spokesperson worldwide for this issue. Is this a good thing? Does he help us understand this issue and take action on the issue?
Well, he's right on top of the science. I have absolutely nothing but admiration for his ability to, I mean, he's not a scientist himself. I mean, so that's the potential downside, is you have somebody who's not a scientist sort of trying to speak science to people. But he does a very good job of it. I was impressed in his movie when he told about how he was in Roger Revelle's class when the very first data about the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere going up was coming off the press. And so, you know, this professor showed his students this information that, you know, could mean that you know, terrible things could happen. So he was right there on the ground floor.
Mm-hmm. He had the Senate's first climate change hearing 20 years ago. Why haven't we paid a whole lot of attention to this issue in the last 20 years?
Well, you kind of want to wait for a smoking gun. You sort of want to wait for proof. And as recently as 1995, it was impossible to see global warming actually happening in the world, and then by 1995 or so, certainly by 2000, it was very clear. And so now we're starting to, you know, it takes a little bit of time for the wake-up call to get through to everybody. But now that you can see global warming actually happening in the temperature of the Earth, now there's more of a cause for doing things, I guess.
Mm-hmm. There is, and the AP broke this story last weekend, looking at an advanced look at the draft of this international scientific report that's due out in April that looks at the effects of global warming on daily life that are already showing up. Is this a big report that we need to pay attention to, or do we already know the information?
Well, this is a report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, and they've been publishing these reports that sort of summarize the state of the peer-reviewed scientific literature every 5 years or so. The last one was in the year 2000. And I don't know that there's any huge revolutions in our understanding since the last one. So in that sense, IPCC is becoming kind of less interesting because, you know, the science is kind of more settled. But on the other hand, a lot more people are interested now. So, I mean, you know, lay people out in the world. And so the headlines are bigger. And in that sense, the IPCC reports that are just coming out now are maybe more important than the ones in the past.
Mm-hmm. With the change of leadership in the House and the Senate, I was reading yesterday, Professor Archer, that over 9 bills related to climate change have been introduced in the Senate just in the past 2 months. The House, Nancy Pelosi, created the Select Committee on Climate Change. Do you see political action? We got the committees. Do you see action on this issue now because there's been a change of leadership?
I've heard it's very possible that things could happen even before the next election.
Mm.
And, you know, if the climate forecast is right, the warming and the other sort of alarming trends that we've seen are only going to get more intense, and so the political pressure is only going to ratchet up. It's only a matter of time.
What do we need to do?
Need to stop building coal-fired power plants.
Hmm.
We build these things, and they last for 50 years, and the way they're built, it's not so easy to trap the carbon, the CO2, from the smokestacks because it's mixed with other gases from the atmosphere, and so, you know, off it goes. But there are other things that can be done with coal, something called gasification, and where you convert the coal into hydrogen and carbon monoxide, then you burn that, and it not only is it more efficient for getting energy, but it also delivers carbon dioxide in a pure CO2 stream, which is much cheaper to capture, and then you can squirt it down into the earth or something like that to keep it out of the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
But we got to start now because these plants, once they're built, it's a lot more painful to shut down a perfectly, you know, working coal-fired power plant once it gets built. So I think there's sort of a frenzy of building these things or proposing them now to try to get them in under the wire before the regulations change and then try to grandfather them in.
Uh-huh. And is that a huge source of CO2 emissions?
I don't have all the numbers right to hand. I think it's on the order of a third from coal. We, you know,
that's
the U.S.
a lot.
Has a lot of the world's coal deposits here, and China has a lot of coal as well. So, you know, if we have the engineering technology, infrastructure and the disposable income here to figure out how to do other things with it, and then we can sell that technology to other countries.
Is that an expensive process, Professor Archer?
I guess currently the way things stand, what I've read is that if you count the cost of capturing the carbon, it's cheaper overall to do the newer technology. The newer technology, however, is new, and so there's, you know, more trouble. I mean, it's very easy to build a coal-fired plant because we've been doing it for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
They do use very similar technology to make hydrogen that is part of producing fertilizers, where they take nitrogen gas from the atmosphere and make ammonia from it. And so all of the bits and pieces that you need to do this IGCC, integrated gasification combined cycle, all the pieces of that are things that you can just order from, you know, industrial catalogs. So it's not pie in the sky, but it's not business as usual either.
Mm-hmm. And what about some of the what we're still calling alternative forms of energy? Do we need to press ahead with some kind of technology that looks more promising and is clean?
Yeah, sure. So the question is whether, you know, the government or somebody should choose winners and then, you know, subsidize windmills or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of Adam Smithian view would be to just put a tax on CO2 emission, which essentially is just making the person who emits the CO2 pay for the cost of the CO2, and then the market will figure out what the best way of making energy without producing CO2 would be. That's generally thought to be a more efficient way of making those kinds of decisions.
Mm-hmm. And what about this issue that always comes up when we talk about this, that it doesn't do any good for the United States to take on this issue. Let's look at coal-fired power plants. You mentioned China. The thought is, well, you know, doesn't make any difference. We do something, but what about China? What about India? They're still contributing to global warming in a huge way.
Not as much as we are.
Hmm.
We're putting out more in the U.S. I mean, this won't last forever. In the next couple of decades, China will surpass us. That's true. But right now, the U.S. is putting out much more CO2 than either China or India. And that's in spite of the fact that we have a much smaller population. So our emission per person, we actually emit twice as much carbon dioxide per person as even they do in Europe or Japan or most of the rest of the industrialized world. And so, you know, since we've been making the mess, it only makes sense for us to invest something in cleaning it up. And then also we have this capacity to innovate here. You know, it seems like we can put people on the moon. We could design IGCC power plants.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we do that, then the technology in other parts of the world can sort of leapfrog ahead and just jump right to the most. It's like cell phones where some parts of the world, like in Israel, for example, they didn't even put in landlines because cell phones had been developed, and that was cheaper, so they could just sort of leapfrog.
Hmm. You mentioned when I asked what we should do, stop building coal-fired power plants, number one. What's number two?
Well, so a tax on carbon dioxide emissions would sort of be a general solution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's factor of two changes that can easily be made in virtually all the different parts of the economy that release greenhouse gases. The hybrid cars get twice as much mileage per gallon as regular ones do, maybe not twice as much, but considerably better gas mileage. And compact fluorescent light bulbs get they're four times more efficient. So Australia has actually made a move to ban incandescent light bulbs. They're phasing them out by in the next couple of years. Only criminals will have incandescent light bulbs in Australia, which is amazing because Australia is one of the other is sort of the other Kyoto Protocol holdout country.
Oh,
and so they've gone 180 degrees there.
Uh-huh. And is that catching on in the United States? Do you know how many people are buying those bulbs now?
I have read that they are now dominant in commercial lighting, you know, in stores.
Hmm.
But in households, they are not making their people are not buying them.
Mm-hmm.
They are more expensive a little bit than incandescent light bulbs when you plunk down your money at the cash register. They do save money though in the long run because they last longer and they're more efficient.
Yeah,
it's not an immediate thing, you know, not something so tangible really.
Maybe it'll take us a little longer than Australia, but I did see a news report just a couple weeks ago saying that essentially those incandescent bulbs just won't be made in this country in the not-too-distant future.
I think that was one of Al Gore's. Didn't he have a list of 10 proposals that he presented yesterday? I didn't actually get to find that list, but I thought I saw a reference in a newspaper article that was one of the items on it.
Right. Let's welcome phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Al Gore, once again, focused a great deal of attention on global warming yesterday with his appearance in Washington before House and Senate committees, urging lawmakers to take drastic measures to address what he called a true planetary emergency. And we're welcoming your calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we're going to be looking at buy local, buy Wisconsin, buy local foods. There is recent legislation in the state Senate creating a buy local, buy Wisconsin initiative to encourage local food markets. We'll be talking about what it means to buy local, why it's good for farmers, why it's good for our health. And that's the second hour of our show. All right, two phone calls for Professor David Archer, professor in the Department of the Geophysical Sciences at the University of Chicago. He is the author of a textbook, Global Warming, Understanding the Forecast, and his new book is From Here to Eternity, Global Warming in Geologic Time. Our number, 800-486-8655. Terry from Mercer is our first caller. David, hi, Terry.
thanks for letting me join in. I'm actually working on a climate change education project up here in the Northwoods called Paradise Lost. It's a traveling art and science exhibit.
Oh.
A lot of UW faculty have been the scientists. And we had our first show in Rhinelander last month, and it was really interesting the comments that people had. We did show Inconvenient Truth as part of a larger educational venue with speakers and panelists. But people really associate that with politics, and oftentimes we're finding that kind of colors their view of the information. And I think one of the big challenges is to try and get people past the politics to actually look at the science involved.
The politics meaning what? That because Al Gore brought this forward, it's
right.
A political thing? I see.
Right. And, you know, I listed some things about our show on a Snowmobiler website. We're trying to appeal to a variety of audiences, and most of the comments I've received from those folks, you know, they don't believe it because a politician is talking about it. So
I
see. It's kind of an interesting catch-22.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Al Gore can't seem to get a break. I heard a reference to something called the Al Gore effect, that whenever he goes to give a major talk someplace, they always have cold, crummy, very un-global warming-like weather.
Hmm.
It's a funny thing.
Hmm.
I on the one hand, he did sort of have a political, I mean, he is a politician. On the other hand, he has the notoriety to be heard, and his movie was very good. I mean, it was very well presented. So, yeah, I know what you're talking about. I don't know. I don't have any easy answers, I guess.
So, Terry, are you touring the state with this production, or what?
Yes, we started about a year ago getting ready for it. We have 20 artists from around the region who created pieces, and then the science goes with it. And it'll be going right now. In fact, I'm moving it up to Gogebic Community College in Ironwood. We open there March 31st, and then we're going to Ashland, Manitouche Waters, Wausau, and then on to Madison. So we've got kind of a traveling schedule coming up with the show.
Great. Do you have a place where people can find out the listing of performances?
Yes, they could go to it's actually UW-Madison website, the Center for Biology Education, so it's Wisconsin. I don't have the exact letters, but it's the CBE is the letters in the actual website. If you hold on just a sec, I'm pulling out my piece of paper here.
Okay.
That has the website on it is www.wisc.edu/CBE.
Wait, you're a little fast for me. Wisc.edu/CBE. CBE.
/K-12.
Okay.
/Paradise Lost.
Okay.
One word, HTML.
Paradise Lost. Okay. Great.
Well,
all right.
Thanks.
Thank
and,
you.
Thanks for this program.
Thanks. Thanks for
mm-hmm.
doing your work. Let's go next to Keith from Shorewood. Hi, Keith.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Keith.
Dr. Archer. How you doing?
Hello.
Nice to hear things are going on up in Mercer. I spent a lot of time up there as a kid. This global climate change thing is still unsettled in a lot of people's minds, largely because I think the mainstream media, in their effort to try to provide this false balance on issues, is kind of confusing people. But in order to get things such as control of CO2 gases, as you were talking about, the CO2 tax and other things, including things at the state level, it's going to take some grassroots efforts or politicians waking up to what people want to see happening in this area. And that comes down to people talking to other people. What type of arguments do you find really, you know, when you're talking to a climate change skeptic, sort of, you know, because I got a feeling you're not going to totally change them, but sort of makes them stop in their tracks and think a little bit about the situation to get a little more serious about it?
Well, you know, there are a variety of there are those who sort of will try to raise issues of uncertainty about, well, you know, the way that clouds are done is not very, very reliable in the models, and so, you know, obviously the whole thing is not reliable, and we shouldn't take it too seriously. In general, I guess I would say that The warming that has happened in the last couple of decades is sort of a smoking gun. We've sort of seen it happening, and if there were some reason why future CO2 increases in the atmosphere would not lead to further warming, then, you know, we wouldn't be seeing the warming today. So in the scientific arena, there's no competing viable theory that
right.
doesn't predict global warming. The argument is sort of in the popular arena, which is, and like I say, it's normally designed to sort of sow confusion. And this is just a phenomenon that's just going to happen. You also have people who don't believe that HIV causes AIDS or cigarettes cause lung cancer, and, you know, that's just, I mean, people are entitled to have their opinions and say whatever they like.
They are, except that, you know, when you see somebody like Senator Inhofe yesterday and his interaction with Senator Gore, you look at him and you say, he talks about these thousands of scientists who say this isn't happening, and Gore comes back with the National Academy of Science and all of the scientists of the world who have studied this, and they look like idiots. You know, I don't know what position he's espousing here, what good it is to say this isn't happening, but it's like whether or not there's evolution. It seems as though this is a given. Let's just move beyond this. We don't have time to debate this or not. People say it's happening. Respected people who have studied this say this is happening. We must act.
Yeah, there's a quote from Daniel Patrick Moynihan, that everyone is entitled to their own opinion, but not entitled to their own facts.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, Inhofe definitely raised some incorrect facts yesterday, and he's coming across, to me, as increasingly idiotic, but,
mm-hmm. Right.
You know, still, he, you know, can't, I mean, what are we going to do?
Thanks, Keith, very much for the call. Let's go to Dave next from Green Bay. Hi, Dave, you're on the air.
Oh, Kathleen, thanks for letting me on.
Mm-hmm.
I hate missing your show. It's always so interesting.
Thanks.
Global warming, and I cannot see how anybody can argue the facts about global warming. It's there. But people don't realize that when the ice caps melt, that's going to be 200 meters of ocean increase. In Milwaukee, it'll be under 80 feet of water.
Well, that's a pretty... Actually, the number I've heard for the total sea level rise, if all of the ice caps were to melt, is about 70 meters, 70, 75, something like that. That's still a huge amount of water. And to be fair, the forecast for the coming century is for, you know, on the order of a half a meter or a meter. But on a longer sort of geological time scales, the sea level changes quite a bit more with changing temperature than it does just in a short time span like 100 years. I'm working on this book about how global warming fits into the longer time scale.
But the other aspect of the CO2 increase I don't hear too much about is the acidification of the ocean,
mm-hmm.
and the loss of the buffering capacity of the ocean to absorb this. And with the acidification, the effect will be on the diatoms and the other single-celled organisms,
mm-hmm.
that's the basis of all life on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's clearly documented effect on corals. You can change the CO2 concentration above corals, and you see them growing more slowly. Corals are always battling these organisms that are sort of crunching them up, and they have to grow at a certain rate in order to outpace these things. And if they grow too slowly, they won't be able to. Corals are also under assault just by the rising temperatures and by, you know, runoff and you know, fertilizer that makes the water cloudy and things like that. And then the single-celled creatures that you make reference to, those are a lot harder to pin down. There are tank experiments that are being run up in Norway. A colleague of mine grows these things under different CO2 concentrations and tries to see how they go. And the response that they get is different depending on what kind of phytoplankton, you know, what specific species of organisms are in there. And I think it's well beyond our reach to predict what the effect would be on the whole ocean. It's a scary issue, though, to change the pH. I mean, the pH chemistry of the ocean is the same chemistry as we have in our bloodstream. And if you pass out and stop breathing, your blood starts to get acidic, too, because of the CO2 that comes from respiration in your cells. And then when the paramedics get there, they have to restore the pH of your blood by giving you an injection before you can start, your heart will start beating again. It's sort of an analogous issue, I think, to the ozone hole, that, you know, it seemed very fundamental to the way the Earth worked and very frightening, but yet the specific, you know, on-the-ground practical impacts were a little hard to pin down. There were stories when the ozone hole was, you know, big discussion about blind rabbits in Patagonia, and, you know, that was like, you know, National Enquirer kind of thing. That wasn't real. But, yes, I agree. It's a frightening thing.
It sure is. Thanks very much for the call, Dave.
Thank you.
Yeah. Our number is 800-486-8655. Can we talk about cars a minute here? I'm interested in their contribution to CO2, greenhouse gas emissions. I'm interested in increase in fuel standards. I'm interested in why we don't make movement right away to get away from gas for cars. How big an issue is this, and why is it so hard to do something as simple, at least it seems simple, as increasing the fuel efficiency of a car?
Well, politically, it's not simple because people view this as sort of their standard of living and their, you know, American way and all of that.
Right. Drive an SUV.
Well, yeah. And so I've heard the perspective that when somebody like Senator Inhofe, for example, starts making claims about how Americans are going to have to drive these ridiculous little smart cars like they have in Europe, which I actually think are very cute cars, by the way, what they're really doing is stalling, because actually transportation is one of the more difficult things to really, really cut way back on CO2 emissions. We could just in a couple of years probably cut our oil use in half by setting aggressive fuel standards. The technology for doing that is there. But to go beyond that, if you want to talk about, you know, electric cars or hydrogen or something, there's sort of new technical hurdles that have to be overcome before the CO2 emissions can really go away from cars. Mm-hmm. And airplanes, there's no real viable way on the table for having, you know, no CO2 emissions from airplanes. You can't run airplanes on batteries or anything like that. It's a difficult problem.
Yeah. We go to Rick next from Oshkosh. Hi, Rick.
Good morning. Hi. Two questions. The guest mentioned we should stop using coal as a energy source. I thought they had found some technology with these scrubbers and stuff to make that safer, and I certainly hope he's not proposing nuclear construction. And the other one is fluorescent bulbs. Years ago, there was this big deal about whether or not these bulbs were harmful to people working under them, with the constant flashing and the sounds of the starters and all this. And all of a sudden, we don't hear anything about the harmfulness of fluorescent bulbs because we're trying to, of course, save the planet. So I wonder if you have any information on either of those things.
Well, your first question about coal, I agree with you. There are sort of promising new things that can be done with coal by gasifying the coal and then capturing the CO2. And the thing is that to get through the next couple of decades and satisfy our energy requirements without while cutting CO2, it's impossible to just stop using coal, much as I would be delighted if that could happen. So alternative ways of dealing with coal, like you say, are definitely a good way to go. With respect to nuclear, you know, there's issues about storing the waste and about nuclear proliferation, and it's not really a long-term solution. It could help out for the coming decades, but it couldn't supply all of our energy needs for, you know, the year 2100, for example, because for one thing, there's just not that much sort of mineable uranium of the kind that we're currently using. It might be possible to extract uranium from seawater, which would get around that issue. But then there's also the issue of this waste, which lasts for, you know, tens of thousands of years, and we're talking about generating it for, you know, to get us through a couple of decades of energy needs. That being said, when I get my energy bill here in Chicago, it tells me that most of my electricity comes from nuclear, and that makes me feel better than if it was coming from a coal-fired power plant, I have to say.
Really?
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess so.
Mm-hmm.
Compact fluorescence. I haven't heard anything about the flashing effect. I have heard that they have mercury in them, and so there's a disposal issue. We don't want to let this mercury out into the environment. I guess with every two steps forward, there's a step back.
Right, right. Senator Gore talked about freezing carbon emissions and reducing all greenhouse gas emissions by the year 2050. Can we do that? Can we reduce all greenhouse gas emissions by then?
Well, CO2 is the big one. The second biggest one is methane, and methane is a more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2 is, molecule for molecule. There aren't as many of them, so overall CO2 is more important. But stopping a molecule of methane is more helpful than stopping a molecule of CO2, and there are lots of things that can be done there, like capturing methane from landfills. You can just sort of put a layer of dirt over landfills, and the bacteria will scrub the methane, and it doesn't cost nearly anything. Or you can capture it and burn it for fuel. Another gas is N2O, nitrogen dioxide. Nitrous oxide, I guess. It's laughing gas. It's what you get at the dentist.
Mm-hmm.
And that's mostly coming from agriculture. And it didn't. My reading of the draft of the IPCC report coming out was that it wasn't so easy to reduce the emissions of that. It mostly comes from fertilizer. So we put nitrogen on the soil in a form of nitrate and ammonia, and bacteria convert it into this N2O. In terms of stopping global warming, if we could freeze the emission rate of CO2 at its present-day level and sort of hold it there for the next couple of decades and then sort of slowly start ramping it down, that would be fine. The business-as-usual forecast has the CO2 emissions doubling by 2050, and that's what we have to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
mm-hmm.
not like we have to go cold turkey on CO2. We just have to stop things from ramping up any further and start ratcheting it back.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that hard, I don't think. It can be done with conventional, you know, with things we know how to do.
Thanks, Rick, very much for your call. We go next to Tony. Hi, Tony.
Good morning. Thank you for the show.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like the issue cleared up. if a pound of coal were burned at a electrical generating plant, how much energy will I get at my outlet percentage-wise from that pound of coal? What is the energy
efficiency
loss in distribution?
I think most of the energy loss, so you burn the coal and you use that to boil water to make steam, and then you drive a turbine. And so I think the typical efficiency of that is about 30%. And so then the other 70% is just heat that's kind of wasted. If you do gasification, you convert the coal to these combustible gases. And then you can combust the gas and run it through a turbine directly. You can't put coal powder into a turbine because the grit, you know, will screw up the bearings or whatever.
Well, I guess my question isn't so much the process of turning coal into energy, but it's the distribution loss when you generate power at 100,000 volts and then you step it down to 110 volts, you know,
yeah,
in my home. I guess my issue is there seems to be a lot of emphasis on geothermal energy, and I'm a mechanical contractor, so I love water source heat pump systems.
Huh.
However, I think there's a huge misconception in the sense that as long as the compressor that is driven by electricity that is generated by soft coal that is delivered by a system that's maybe 30% efficient,
yep,
that the total carbon contribution to the environment may actually even be greater than it would be just burning natural gas, in the sense that the total contribution of carbon from cradle to grave may be greater because we're generating the electricity with coal.
Yeah. Yeah, those are that's definitely the way to look at these things, from the total CO2 emissions per, you know, at the end of the day. And it's hard. They talk about generating ethanol from corn as being sort of a neutral process in terms of CO2 emissions because it takes so much fossil fuel energy to drive the tractors, I guess, to harvest the corn and also to make the fertilizers that, in the end, a gallon of ethanol is, you know, comes from a gallon of gasoline, and so you don't really get that much out of it. It's a hard way, I mean, it's a hard analysis to pin down, and so there's sort of eternal argument about exactly what the details are, but that's definitely the way to analyze things. I agree with you.
About math?
What's that, Tony?
Isn't it really all about math in the sense that these things are highly calculatable, that if we know how much electricity is consumed from your electric meter, and you take up, you know, the aggregate of all those electric bills, and you look at all the coal that's burned, and you know the locomotive that to mine the coal, to transport the coal, to burn the coal, to consume the power, it's my contention that when individuals burn fossil fuels on their own in the form of natural gas, they actually may be less harmful to the environment than when they buy power to drive their other means of energy. And really the only form of energy that doesn't have a carbon footprint are solar or wind.
Yeah, that's true. No, I think you're right.
Thanks very much for the call, Tony. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. motivated perhaps by, well, we've done a lot of shows on this, but today's show, prompted by Senator Al Gore's appearance before House and Senate committees yesterday, in which he talked about the planet having a fever, and that fever is global warming. If your baby has a fever, you go to the doctor. If the doctor says you have to intervene here, you don't say, well, I read a science fiction novel that says this isn't important. So he met before the House Energy and Commerce Committee, the Science and Technology Committee, and said that global warming is a crisis that is by far the most serious we've ever faced. It dwarfs the post-World War II reconstruction of Europe, the rise of communism, the ravages of disease and civil war in the developing world. I'm Kathleen Dunn. More phone calls in a moment. Keep the number in mind. Our lines have been crowded, but I hope if you're trying to, you're able to get through. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 227-2050 or 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Our guest is Professor David Archer. He's a professor in the Department of the Geophysical Sciences at the University of Chicago, teaches classes on global warming, and is author of Global Warming, Understanding the Forecast, which is a science textbook for non-science majors. He's working on a new book, From Here to Eternity, Global Warming in Geologic Time. John from Milwaukee is our next caller. Hi, John.
Hi. I think that there's a consensus that global climate change exists. What I think is the problem is that we don't really know how much is actually being contributed by humans. And that's, conveniently enough, an argument that I don't think we could ever prove as to how much is actually being formed by human beings. So what I do is I try, when I talk with people about it, I say, well, I don't have so much of a problem with whether we're right or wrong, because what I try and do is I look at the consequences. I say, if you look at what are the consequences if we do nothing and we're wrong, it's a very serious consequence. If you look at the consequences of doing something proactively now and we are wrong, the consequences, in my opinion, are very positive. Two examples would be, first of all, I think GM is talking about a new type of car called the Volt. And the car that they've described is a car that would actually be able to drive, I think, 40 miles after a recharge overnight without having to use any consumption of gasoline at all. Now, you still have to accept the fact that the electricity could come from coal, but it can come from nuclear, it can come from hydro, it can come from natural gas. There are all sorts of sources. It could come from wind power, and so you're going to be reducing carbon that way. You reduce the amount of noise in the cities because they're electric cars. You reduce the amount of air pollution in general in metropolitan areas. You could use the car for powering your house in an emergency. You actually make cars cheaper to make because because they would be putting standard electric motors in the wheels and the hubs, and you don't have separate factories for building separate engines. And then another consequence that I talk about is the consequence of combined heat and power plants that are being used for distributed power generation, where you can actually put an electrical generator in your home using either fuel cells or small internal combustion turbines, where they generate the electricity locally from natural gas inside your home. And the waste heat, that 40% waste heat that you were discussing earlier that gets thrown out in a Lake Michigan, would actually be used to heat your home. And then also another caller who called earlier was talking about other wastes in the generation format that we have set up now. And that, I think if I understand it correctly, is it takes about 15% of the energy to transport the energy from, say, the nuclear power plant in Two Rivers to Milwaukee. So you're not only wasting 40% of the energy by dumping the heat into Lake Michigan, you're also wasting another 15% that gets used up as heat in the electrical wires for transporting it down. And if you have combined heat and power plants that are used locally, and we can do that today with small turbines or in the future with fuel cells, you're eliminating all of that waste because that waste heat can be used for heating your home, and because you're generating the electricity within your home, you're also able to take advantage of the heat.
Professor Archer.
I agree with you, and I would add one item to your list, which is the small particles in the air from coal power plants cause asthma. So if we were to go with a cleaner technology for coal, that would be another sort of co-benefit. Mm-hmm. The one thing I disagree with you on, though, is your characterization that we don't know how much of the warming is caused by humans. Actually, the sensitivity of the climate to changes in CO2 is not a really difficult... I mean, that the prediction that the climate should be as sensitive as it is goes back over 100 years now, and we... You know how much the CO2 concentration has been going up, and we know that's because of human activity. And the other things that can change climate are cloudiness or changes in the sun or volcanic eruptions or these aerosols I mentioned a second ago. And there are measurements of all those things as well over the past couple of decades. And, you know, none of those are trending to make the climate get warmer. The only one that is acting to make the climate get warmer is greenhouse gases. So, you know, a lot of the arguments from the climate contrarians are, well, you know, maybe the sun has more of an impact than you think. Yeah. It's true that there are uncertainties about the sun, but if you want to say that CO2 is not doing it, you got to explain why it should not be when we can measure very easily that it does have this effect on infrared light. It's like, you know, in the game of Clue, if you're trying to frame the chauffeur when the butler, you know, you caught him and he's got a smoking gun in his hand. You got to not only come up with the evidence to convict the chauffeur, but you also got to come up with the evidence to clear the butler.
What in the world brought up that game? I haven't played that game in years, Professor Archer.
Oh, it's a good one.
Yeah, it is a good one. Thanks, John, for the call. Let's go to Sue from Waldo. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I just wanted to mention the impact that buildings have on climate change. They're actually the number four in a sector analysis for global greenhouse gas emissions.
Yep.
And in fact, the overwhelming majority of electricity produced by power plants, like 76%, is used to heat and operate buildings in the ants. And there's a really great opportunity. There's expectations of like 75% of our buildings are projected to be either they're new or remodeled by the year 2035. So we have great opportunities to change their impact on the environment. And in fact, there's an organization, Architecture 2030, that's striving to help architects and people in the building industry to change the way they construct building with the Green Building Movement. And there's a the person that's kind of the head of that, Edward Mazaria, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, is actually coming to UWM on April 20th. And he's going to give a presentation, apparently. It's open to the public.
Great.
Yeah, there are, like I said before, there are a factor of two cuts in CO2 emissions that can come from almost all of the sectors that emit CO2, and buildings are no exception. If you continue to get benefits by putting in twice the insulation that the local building code requires, it still helps cut down heating and cooling costs even further. And you're absolutely right. In fact, I read in the upcoming IPCC report, the draft of it, that most of the CO2 emission cuts from the building sector would actually pay for themselves, as opposed to in other sectors where they, you know, there is some cost involved. The building sector is what we call low-hanging fruit. It's very easy things to change. Mm. And they also call it no regrets because, you know, it's a good thing for the global warming, and it also pays for itself.
Yeah.
So, you know, who could argue with that?
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Jim next from Milwaukee. Hello, Jim.
Yeah, hi. Well, I think the theme is the same. Whether you're talking about executive privilege or global warming, the mentality is we're in charge, we run things the way we want, and we don't want you to know, and we certainly don't want you to act. Because if they admitted that there was a problem, then they'd have to do something about the problem, and doing something about the problem, like having a quantum breakthrough in productivity and fuel economy, would affect the ability of the oil companies to gouge us. So quite naturally, they're going to obstruct and slow play and study the problem ad infinitum, but they really don't want to act.
You expect significant action, Professor Archer, and if so, when?
Well, like I say, I've heard that a climate bill could be passed through Congress even in the next couple of years before the next major election. And if it doesn't, I think it's only a matter of time. I mean, you know, at some point, the climate contrarians and the sort of voices of industry are arguing against Mother Nature.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you can't do that forever.
Yeah.
You know, a few more Katrinas
or
you know, nasty heat waves or things like that.
Or a lot fewer polar bears.
For example.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks, Jim. Glenn from Eau Claire. Hi.
Hello, me. I'm up.
Go ahead.
Thanks.
Morning.
I got a bunch of questions when you mentioned that Mr. Gore. He came up with a study from some university think tank or something. They had a pretty good model. A guy I heard talking, I don't know what station, but he said he commends them. They come very close to, but there's some things that you can't possibly put into a model to exactify, if that's a word, reality. And
what are you getting at here, Glenn?
How can he possibly... somebody said that Mr. Gore came up with a model through some think tank, some university or something, and they come up with all these gases and all the such and like this and that, but you can't exactify that. There's other... a wind come in and blow all your little chemicals that are doing all these things to temperature change. And what about the... if it's a heat wave coming, what about hasn't there been extreme cold, record cold? Ain't been that cold in Kansas City in 40 years.
Okay, Professor Archer.
Well, there's variability in the climate just naturally. There's going to be warm times and cold times regardless of whether people were on Earth or not. But the average temperature of the Earth has been going up, and the forecast as early as 1995 was that it's going to keep going up, and the years since then have proven that forecast to be right. It's true that models are never going to be perfect, but let me put it to you this way. If the weatherman says 90 to 99% chance of rain, you know, you take your umbrella, right? I mean, weather models are pretty good. They don't always get everything exactly right, and there's no way that a forecast of climate in 100 years is going to get everything exactly right either. But the general trend is pretty strong.
One more call. It has to be quick, less than a minute. Peter from Ashland. Hi.
I have a comment on your comments about coal gasification.
Mm-hmm.
In Ashland, where I live, we had a coal gasification plant at the turn of the century. It was used to make basically kind of an LP gas
right.
of sorts. And we had a big... consequence of that, and that was a byproduct of coal gasification is coal tar.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, you know, they thought that they could pump this out into Lake Superior and in Shawangan Bay, where we're at. And now we have coal tar sediment that's in our bay. And, you know, it's considered a Superfund site now.
Yeah. And on that note, we have about 10 seconds, Professor Archer.
Well, you're right. And coal mining also is never going to be a green process. So if I had my voice, if I had my choice, I would vote for windmills personally.
Right.
I agree with you.
Well, we're glad we've had your voice this hour, too. Thanks, Professor Archer, for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Professor David Archer is a professor in the Department of the Geophysical Sciences at the University of Chicago and has authored a textbook for non-science major undergraduates titled Global Warming, Understanding the Forecast. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production in our studios here in Milwaukee. And thank you, everybody, as always, for all of your informed calls. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with some more Thursday morning conversation. So please stay with us, and we'll welcome your calls as we talk about food, glorious food. First, the latest news.